Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Professor David Smith, lecturer in the Department of Government and International Relations at the University of Sydney, and that's out in Australia. He also serves there as a key faculty member in the American Studies program. David was a popular guest previously on our program back in February, and he is currently finishing up as a distinguished visiting scholar here at the University of Washington. I wanted to get him back on the show one more time before he left because he's a really smart guy, and international interviews are a bit difficult for me to do. Dr. Smith's earlier podcast with us was on the topic of religious persecution in U.S. history, and I strongly urge our listeners to go back and visit it if you haven't done so already. We always link related podcasts and other neat stuff on our website, so that's where you can find it. Stop by and visit us at www.researchonreligion.org. David, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Thank you for having me back.
Okay, our format for today is going to have a bit of a twist on it. I'm basing our conversation off of a review essay of three books that David wrote for the Australian Journal of Political Science, examining the role of religion in U.S. foreign policy. And I want to use this essay as a platform for a more open-form discussion on that topic, and then also visit some of the other things that David has written on evangelicals and U.S. climate policy, which is a hot topic as of late, if I can make that pun. So does that sound like a good thing?
That sounds great to me.
Okay, and there's another first going on here at Research on Religion. I'm actually eating a sandwich while doing this interview. So first time, we'll see how that goes. If it works out well, there'll be more sandwiches in the future. So the three books that you wrote about in this review essay, they were Stephen Rock's Faith and Foreign Policy, Eric Patterson's Politics in a Religious World, and Andrew Preston's Sword of the Spirit and Shield of the Faith. Your essay, however, also covers a number of other books and articles on the topic from authors like Tom Farr, Tim Shaw, Dan Philpott, and Bob Woodbury, all of them who have been on the show in the past. So we'll link to all those books and those previous interviews on our website, as we mentioned before. Now, some of you might be wondering why I just don't talk with the authors of those three aforementioned books directly, but the answer is simply David's really fun to talk to. So there you have it.
Thank you.
All right. So first general question. We're both political scientists, and we both study the subtopic of religion and politics. Most of the work on religion and politics outside of political philosophy has been really looking at how religious beliefs and institutions intermix with domestic politics, not only in the U.S., which is what your current research examines, but in different countries around the world. And that's the kind of stuff that I focused on. Rarely, however, do we see any focus on religion in the study of international relations and or foreign policy. Is this a correct read of the field? And if so, why do you think that is?
It is a correct read of the field, yes. And since 2000, there's been a lot more written about the role of religion in international relations. And I've got a small library of this stuff now back in my office in Sydney, but it is a small library, especially compared to the huge amount of work that's been done on religion and domestic politics and the huge amount of work that's been done in other areas of international relations. Now, one of the first articles about this was by Jonathan Fox in 2001, and it was an article that was trying to explain why religion had actually been left out prior to this point. And he argued that it was because of a pervasive bias towards secularization theory in the social sciences, which we're both very familiar with and which I imagine your listeners are probably familiar with at this point. And he also said that people raised within the religious political environment of the United States, where you are taught to think of church and state as separate, had also carried a kind of bias from that with them into the study of international relations, which meant of thinking of religion as something completely separate from the state. And a third factor he said was that religion was very difficult to quantify, and religious variables were difficult to quantify. Now, with respect to Jonathan Fox, who's done as much as anybody to advance this field, I would actually say I think that the root cause of the lack of attention to religion in international relations goes all the way back to the Peace of Westphalia in 1648.
Wow, that's a long ways back.
So we're going to start off by going a long way back. And so the Peace of Westphalia is what brought decades of religious conflict to an end in Europe. And the basic bargain of the Peace of Westphalia actually created modern states as we understand them today, which are the basic units of international relations. And this bargain that was reached was that every ruler of every country would decide which was the dominant religion in that country, which was the state religion. But in order to prevent these rulers from attacking minorities in their own countries and then causing other countries to attack minorities in their countries in retaliation, there was also a basic agreement that religious minorities in these countries, and we're usually talking Protestants in Catholic countries and Catholics in Protestant countries, would have some rights. They wouldn't be equal, but they would have some rights and some protection. And as Stephen Krasner, in one of the great books of international relations, Sovereignty, Organized Hypocrisy, wrote, this was actually the beginning of the entire discourse of minority rights in the Western world. So this is what the Treaty of Westphalia gives us. And in a very important way, it did actually remove religion from international relations, because it meant that the state would no longer be advancing religion. This was no longer a thing that states did. They would often have a very religious character. They would have a state religion, but rulers no longer saw it as their role, and they really frowned on the idea that the modern state would be used to advance a religion.
Especially across international borders, right?
Especially across international borders. And this basic arrangement throughout the world really holds up more or less until the late 70s. I mean, you see a few exceptions to it, things like the Boer republics that were established in South Africa, the Mormon attempt to establish a theocracy in the middle of the North American desert, or Franco's Spain is probably the closest example we have of a state that had not only an explicitly religious basis, but a state that actually wanted to advance that religion. But really, it's not until the Iranian Revolution that we actually really get the return of religion as part of the reason of state.
Yeah, let me stop here before we get into that, because I want to explore the 1979 Iranian Revolution and how that starts to change the game. But when I know when I talk to our international relations scholars here in our department and throughout our profession widely, there's this issue of realpolitik.
That's
real
right,
politic
yes.
That matters. And if you think about all the stuff that international relations tends to think of, it's usually war, international conflict, or stuff like international trade. And none of that stuff is about, nobody's fighting about religious stuff anymore. You know, maybe you could say, well, the Cold War was communism, secularism versus religion. But, nobody thought about that. It's mostly territory, physical stuff. I trade stuff for your stuff. You trade stuff for my stuff. Is that part of the whole equation here, too, why we don't think of religion very much?
That is part of it. Most schools of thought in international relations are quite materialist. Constructivism is much less materialist. In constructivism, that's all about how the identities of state actors affect the way that they act in the international arena. And there's a lot more room within that research agenda for religion. And in fact, this is one of the ways that it was brought back in. Through a couple of scholars in particular, Daniel Philpott, who you mentioned earlier, and also Elizabeth Shackman Hurd, who wrote a terrific book called The Politics of Secularism in International Relations. And what both of them say in different ways and addressing different aspects is to say, well, hold on a minute. This entire Westphalian system, this secular system where you have this profound separation of religious and state authority that means that religion is no longer advanced materially by states, this didn't come out of nowhere. This actually comes from a very Protestant conception of how politics should be ordered. And Daniel Philpott showed that it was states that had undergone the Reformation that actually most enthusiastically embraced this Westphalian system. And Elizabeth Shackman Hurd argues that often American foreign policy actors have actually failed to understand the rest of the world and failed to understand the Iranian Revolution because this particularly Protestant conception of secularism was so deeply ingrained and was so accepted as, well, this is just what the world was like, that we couldn't see the way in which this was actually a religious construction. Another book, and this is the last bit on this point, another book that's really worth looking at is Daniel Nexon's book, The Struggle for Power in Early Modern Europe, where he takes a step even further back from this and says, oh, okay, Protestantism had some role in constructing the Westphalian system. He thinks it's a bit overrated. But he says what we really need to look at is the way that the Reformation completely disrupted political order in Europe in the 16th century and back before that too, and how remarkable it was that this system of dynastic rule was suddenly torn apart by the Reformation. And he says that the reason why is that the religious differentiation that the Reformation introduced meant that there were new sources of resistance to dynastic rule. You no longer had this religiously uniform population that was fragmented in every other way and was so easy to control. Now, because you had large religious groupings, this created new sources of conflict, new ideas about how things should be done, and this is what brought the medieval system down. So just because the Westphalian system separated state and religious authority, it doesn't mean that religion isn't there in the international system. What it means, as Philpott and Nexon and Elizabeth Shackman Hurd have shown us, that it exists at a very, very deep level in terms of the way that the entire system is structured and the way that we think about it and the mistakes that we make in terms of thinking about it.
I want to back up a little bit and ask you about this term constructivism. We're doing a little bit of self-reflection in academia. You mentioned that constructivism is a pathway to bring the religious factor back into the study of international relations. What exactly is constructivism, and has that been a recent trend in international relations, or has it been there all the time?
Constructivism is a relatively recent trend in international relations compared to some of the older schools like liberalism and realpolitik. So constructivism really comes onto the agenda in the mid-80s in international relations. And part of what constructivism does is to reorient the study of what international relations should be about. It says that we should actually really be taking a very careful look at concepts like anarchy. So realpolitik takes anarchy for granted. It says this is just the way that the world is. All schools of international relations took the Westphalian system for granted. You know, this is just how it is. And constructivists say, no, we really have to look at how we came to hold these ideas about the world in the first place, because these ideas that we have actually really affect the way that political actors interact with each other. And we need to understand that the world isn't just made of tanks and bombs and guns and money. It's made of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And the ideas that we hold really affect the way that politics works. So constructivism is a reorientation of what international relations actually should be about.
I can imagine that this is also very important too. You were talking about the Peace of Westphalia as being an important milestone in world history, but also the way we think about world history. But that was pretty much restricted to Europe. And
that's
there's
right,
a
yes.
bunch of other cultures, other civilizations, to use Samuel Huntington's term, that are out there that might have different conceptualizations that, well, they weren't signatories on the Peace of Westphalia and they view things a lot differently. Does this also start to affect the thinking of international relations scholars in the 80s?
Absolutely, yes. And constructivism especially, it when it's combined with post-colonial theory, which the basis of post-colonial theory is that the world is a very, very different place from the point of view of peoples who were colonized, as opposed to those who were doing the colonizing. Even though it's the colonial viewpoint of the world that traditionally dominates politics, scholarship, everything, post-colonial theory is about seeing the world from the perspective of the colonized. And certainly when constructivism and post-colonial theory meet, yes, you definitely begin to get a more a far more diverse understanding of what political reality might actually involve.
So you mentioned the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran. That must have been a big reorienting factor in a lot of people's thinkings, because you sit there, well, you know, religion, that wouldn't have anything to do with anything else. And then all of a sudden you get this big religious republic there, and some of your ideas are challenged.
Yeah. It's really interesting to look at the effect that the Iranian Revolution had on American foreign policy, because prior to that point, really beginning with Eisenhower, the US had always seen Islam as an ally against communism, because communism was atheist, aggressively so. It suppressed Islam within Soviet borders. It was assumed that Muslims would always take the side of the United States against communism. And so the US often supported, for example, very conservative Muslim states in the Gulf. It thought that Islamist organizations were useful things to support against Arab nationalist and socialist states like Syria and Egypt. And yeah, it was always thought of as an ally prior to that point. The Iranian Revolution really took the United States off guard, because it was this completely different combination of ideologies. It was Islamist, but it was explicitly anti-American as well as anti-communist. And the other thing about the Islamic Revolution was it was a mass participation revolution. And Mahmoud Mamdani, in a very important book called Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, about American foreign policy towards the Islamic world, says that the lesson that a lot of US foreign policymakers took from the Iranian Revolution was that the version of Islam we should be supporting is the one where autocratic rulers use Islam to suppress mass participation, and the dangerous form of Islam was where it actually encourages mass participation. And I think that that kind of bias exists to this day in US foreign policy. I think that US foreign policymakers from both sides have often missed opportunities to engage with Islamic political actors who support democracy. I think an example of this was the Muslim Brotherhood government in Egypt, which was far from perfect, but it was a democratic government. And it was the first time that the Muslim Brotherhood had agreed, after many, many years of internal struggle, to actually submit to the processes of democratic elections. Now, when the Muslim Brotherhood was thrown out in a coup, it took a very long time for the United States to refer to it as a coup. And they still haven't really embraced the idea that this was a coup, because that would mean cutting off military aid to the Egyptian state. I think that this was a huge mistake on the part of the US. And even though it was felt that, well, a Muslim Brotherhood government is not going to be friendly to religious minorities, it's not going to respect the separation of ecclesiastical and state authority, we see that since the coup, conditions have got worse for religious minorities in Egypt. And I would say the lesson from that is that getting rid of democracy is never a good step towards liberalism. So I think that this, and we can come back to this, and this is probably an area that Patterson would really speak to, in terms of there's a pervasive distrust in the US of any form of Islam that encourages mass political participation. And that's a bias that goes all the way back to the Iranian Revolution.
Now, scholars are starting to rethink a lot of this. So we were talking about foreign policy, but what about scholars thinking about foreign policy? They're bringing religion back in, as we brought the state back in and we took the state back out. Now we're bringing religion back in. You've looked at three of these books, Patterson, Rock, and Preston, and a number of other scholars as well. Looking at how religion might play a role in affecting international relations and or more specifically foreign policy, how does this play out? What are the pathways?
So Rock, I think, does a nice job of identifying four specific pathways. So one is lobbying by religious-based interest groups. And this is something we see not just in the US. This is something that we see in a lot of different countries. Now, I would say that the lobbying power of any group, religious, ethnic, even economic interest groups, on foreign policy is limited compared to what they can achieve in domestic policy, and especially in the US. And the basic reason for this is to do with the structure of the United States government. It is way easier to lobby congressmen than it is to lobby the president. Even small groups can actually get somewhere by lobbying Congress. You have to be very, very powerful, sort of GM-level powerful, to be able to lobby the president.
But I assume it's not just lobbying the president, but it's also the whole State Department apparatus, which is
exactly
a bureaucracy that has a life of its own.
Exactly. And this comes back to perhaps another reason why religion has often been left out of international relations. And that is that in the US anyway, foreign policy is seen as the area in which the government is most incubated from popular pressure. And it's been deliberately set up this way. The whole sort of ideology associated with foreign policy often tends to involve a measure of this needs to be kept separate from the people. That this is the realm of high politics, the realm in which experienced statesmen and diplomats have to deal with each other in very high stakes situations, and you do not want this to be subject to popular pressure.
Yeah, in part you can understand that. The populations are very volatile and you have to worry about that. Rather, you want to keep politics inside the domestic borders. It ends at the water's edge, as they say. And I would imagine also that you get a lot of these bureaucrats being trained at all the same schools.
That's right.
Yes. So they have a similar worldview. And if that hasn't included religion or constructivism or anything like that, they're operating in a real world or real politic world still.
That's right. Yeah. So lobbying on foreign policy by religious groups, with some exceptions, which we'll come back to later on, is usually not particularly effective.
What might be some of the lobbying groups? I mean, things that just pop into my mind would be maybe AIPAC or something like that.
Yeah, AIPAC. I mean, things like the Conference of Catholic Bishops.
Okay.
They act as a lobby group, and they're a classic example of, as powerful as they are in their own way, they've been pretty ineffective in lobbying against war, in favor of immigration reform, in favor of nuclear disarmament. That's been a big thing of theirs that has always fallen on deaf ears. So religious leaders in particular, as well as these sort of very specifically set up interest groups like AIPAC. So these are the kinds of lobby groups that we're talking about.
And those issues there, you mentioned human rights, you mentioned nuclear disarmament, immigration, any other issues that would seem to matter? Because again, that might be one of the limiting factors for religion, that just the issues of international relations are not issues that are really salient to any of their members, so why lobby? I mean, you know, trade tariffs on,
yes,
you know, honeybees or something. Who cares about that?
I think you're right. I think that we would probably find in any church, regardless of the denomination, that there are political issues that are far more salient to leaders than they are to the membership. Whether that's a liberal-leaning church or a conservative-leaning church, I think that you find divides between leadership and membership on everything. And yeah, and politicians recognize that the things that matter to the bishops are not going to affect the ways that Catholics actually vote in the United States. It can be it can be different in other parts of the world. I think there's evidence that in a lot of European countries, even countries we think of as being quite secular in terms of having low church membership, the Catholic Church still has a huge amount of influence over policy. And Anna Jemawa-Busa's new book that's going to be coming out on this explains this in a great deal of depth, how in these very culturally secular countries, the Catholic Church still has a lot of power. But this is not so much the case in the United States, where even Catholic public opinion often diverges significantly from the bishops. So Catholics in America are traditionally very supportive of the bishop's view on abortion, but have no truck with the bishop's view on the death penalty, for example.
Yeah.
American Catholics are as pro-death penalty as other Americans, despite the fact the Catholic Church, consistent with its pro-life position, is vehemently against capital punishment.
And that might lead to the second possible pathway of influence that religion has on foreign policy making and international relations, and that's voting behavior, right?
Yes.
And how does this play out?
Well,
or not play out, I guess.
Once again, this is not one of the more effective pathways for foreign policy, and that's because it's very rare that foreign policy matters in national elections or local elections, any kind of elections. Really, you have to be in the middle of a war. It has to be something like the 1968 election or the 2004 election for it to be a major issue. Most of the time, people are not thinking about foreign policy when they're voting. They're thinking about the economy. They're thinking about health, education, all of those kinds of things. Foreign policy is way, way down the list. And so most of the time when the president or congressman are making foreign policy decisions, there's not a lot of evidence that they're doing it thinking about the electoral consequences of what they're doing.
So an evangelical group that wants to mobilize people on such and such issue, maybe religious minorities in another part of the world, probably is not going to get very much traction.
Probably not. Well, we will see the circumstances under which they can get traction, but usually not. If it's an evangelical group that mobilizes against a particular candidate because of their position on abortion, that's very different. Politicians know that that could actually affect the way that people vote. But yes, mobilizing on, say, the rights of Coptic Christians in Egypt.
Not happening. All right. What's the third way that Rock talks about?
So the third way is through the actual personal beliefs of politicians and policymakers. Now, it's hard to believe that politicians who themselves have deep personal faith don't let it affect the way that they govern. I mean, they may talk a lot about how my religion is not going to determine the way that I govern, the classic Kennedy thing, I'm not going to govern for the Vatican. But at the same time, you know, we know the extent to which your religious faith affects the entire way you think, your entire value system, your entire concept of what politics should actually be about. So, of course, we would expect that it affects people. But it's very difficult to see hard evidence of a correlation between the specific religious beliefs associated with a president's religious denomination and what they then do in the foreign policy arena. The classic example of this is Nixon, the Quaker.
He's a Quaker, yeah. Not many people remember that.
He is a Quaker, and he certainly there's a lot of debate about what his real intentions in Vietnam were, and Henry Kissinger has certainly always insisted that it was ultimately about bringing peace. But certainly some of the things that Nixon did on the way to that were really not consistent with the actions of a member of a peace church.
Yeah, Quakers don't bomb Cambodia.
That's right.
Not many of them do.
Exactly. Another example is Jimmy Carter, who is a liberal evangelical, deeply committed to nuclear disarmament. Now, he tried to do it, but he couldn't. His own Congress wouldn't let him, and the Soviet Union wouldn't let him. So presidents themselves are often very constrained when they face foreign policy decisions. They're constrained by circumstances, and they're constrained by the residual powers in the Constitution that do allow Congress to have some input. And so they can't just do what they want. They can't just let their religious beliefs determine the way that they're going to act.
I would imagine the bureaucracy, too, is something that they run
absolutely.
Up against.
Yeah. The bureaucracy, the
State
military.
Department doesn't change that much except at the very top levels. And so yes. There's a lot of institutional momentum in terms of negotiating treaties. And
that's right.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay.
So that, again, not a particularly effective pathway.
What's the fourth way then?
So the fourth way is in some ways the most intriguing but also the most frustrating in terms of trying to discern any effects. And that is the idea that religion so deeply shapes Americans' understanding of who they are. So the idea of American exceptionalism, which is that Americans have a unique mission in the world, that the United States is supposed to be an exemplary country. I mean, in a lot of cases, American exceptionalism is a flat-out statement of we are the best, and we are a godly country, and we should be an example to the rest of the world.
We usually do win the Super Bowl every year. Many Canadian teams have done that.
That's right. Yeah. And this is a deeply religious belief. It begins with John Winthrop's sermon, before he even set foot on North America, on the deck of the Arabella, saying that the United States will be a city on a hill, an example to the rest of the world. By the way, when people quote that sermon, they usually then leave out the next bit, which essentially says, and if we fail, that means we have caused the esteem of God to be lowered in the eyes of the world, and boy, are we going to get punished for that. That never got quoted by Reagan, but the city on the hill, that gets quoted all the time. And, I mean, you just think about how deeply ingrained American exceptionalism is on both sides of politics. It tends to be Republicans who talk about it more these days. And you can see it in the same way that religion is at a level in the international system that's so deep that we might not even notice it. In American foreign policy, maybe it is as well.
Yeah, and I can understand how that is very frustrating for scholars. This is one of those what I call background radiation things that's ever present and might have a big impact, but because of just the duration of the influence that it has, it's very difficult to tease out. But you know, again, you look back in history, and I think you do have to take a historical approach to really understand this better. You look at Manifest Destiny, Making the World Safe for Democracy, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, and this is the thing. You can link all of these different foreign policy traditions to this Christian understanding of American exceptionalism. Yes, Manifest Destiny, as you say, the Wilsonian idea of basically, America's got to save the world after World War I. It's got to set up this system of Westphalian states that has been torn apart by World War I. Also, Jeffersonian isolationism. You know, the original idea of the founding fathers regarding foreign policy was, well, we don't really want foreign policy because we are so morally superior to all of those awful European princedoms that we left behind that if we get involved with them, we are going to be tainted. And that's the basic idea that fuels isolationism all the way through to World War II. But yeah, as a social scientist, this is absolutely maddening. You have three mutually contradictory foreign policy traditions, one of which is aggressive and nationalist, one of which is liberal and internationalist, and one of which says, let's just stay out of this altogether, that are all apparently fueled by the same, as you say, background radiation. So even though we can probably acknowledge that, yes, religion does deeply influence foreign policy in this way, it's very difficult to say how it does or how you would expect it to do so in the future.
It'd have to be mediated through something else. I mean, that's again, right. One, you could say personalities. You have Jefferson yes. being the isolationist. You have Wilson being the liberal internationalist. And you could say Reagan being the aggressive nationalist. So personality might be a situation. But it also might be just world situation because, yeah. You know, it was easy to be isolationist in 1820.
That's right.
Not so easy in 1945, 40, you know, 1950, 1960, right?
Exactly,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Any more examples? As you've read a number of these books, they oftentimes are very historically rich in their descriptions of their theories. What are some examples of how religion might be playing out in U.S. foreign policy throughout history?
Well, I think that the best example, which is one that Andrew Preston talks about at some length, and it's a good example because it shows you the circumstances under which religion can actually affect foreign policy, was to do with the religious human rights movement that emerged in the mid-60s that was lobbying the United States government to take action against the Soviet Union because the Soviet Union would not let religious dissidents go.
And largely Jewish dissidents.
Largely Jewish. Okay. This is the first instance in which you see the Jewish lobby having a real impact. It's not to do with Israel. It's Soviet Union not letting Jews go. I mean, it is to do with Israel because Israel is where they wanted to go. But it's more to do with the Soviet Union. Now, we might think, hang on, the US was effectively at war with the Soviet Union. What are we talking about here in terms of lobbying the US to take action? Well, we sometimes forget that actually from the mid-60s onwards, the United States was trying to move towards normalizing trade relations with the Soviet Union. And this was particularly an aim of Nixon and Kissinger. They believed this was actually the key to ending the Cold War, was normalizing trade relations. Okay, so this meant granting the Soviet Union what used to be known as most favored nation status. I think they've actually abandoned that because it sounds confusing.
It is.
What most favored nation mean? It's not giving someone favored treatment. It's normalizing trade relations. But in the mid-60s, the Jewish lobby campaigns really persistently about these Jewish would-be immigrants who the Soviet Union will not allow to leave. And the attitude of the United States government at the time, the Johnson and Kennedy administrations, is, well, we obviously think religious persecution's bad, but that's an internal matter of the Soviet Union. And we're not going to risk war. We're not going to upset the apple cart here over that.
Sounds like an old piece of Westphalia type of idea.
It is completely a piece of Westphalia idea. Now, the Jewish lobby was certainly able to draw attention to this very effectively by itself. But where this became really effective was when the major Christian groups actually took up the Jewish cause. So first of all, mainline Protestants joined because they were very alarmed by the wars that were going on in the Middle East. They thought that there was a possibility of a new existential threat to the Jewish people, and there was a huge amount of Holocaust guilt within mainline Protestant churches. So they joined the Jewish cause.
And I can imagine also this is coming out of the civil rights movement here in the United States, right?
Exactly,
You move through that and you got some momentum, take it broader.
That's right.
Okay.
And this is, this was a cause of Reinhold Niebuhr and people like that. Now, evangelicals came at it from a bit of a different angle. This is when dispensationalism was really beginning to become big in evangelical circles. And so this is the idea that for the last battle to happen, the Jewish state actually needs to be restored in Israel first. And so evangelicals who have traditionally, if you read Rodney Stark and Charles Glock's book from 1966 about evangelicals and anti-Semitism, evangelicals were traditionally quite suspicious of Jews. They saw them as people who were doomed because of the fact that they had killed Christ. The rise of dispensationalism within evangelicalism changes that picture a lot, which is this is far more towards we need the Jewish state and Jews will actually have a chance to redeem themselves in the dispensationalist picture. So there's this real flip from suspicion of Jews to Judaophilia, I suppose, for want of a better term, within evangelical churches. And then the Catholic Church actually expands the cause further by saying, well, there are all these other religious dissidents in the Soviet Union as well who can't leave. There are a lot of Catholics, particularly in the western parts of the Soviet Union, who can't leave. And then you even get things like there were 32 Pentecostals who wanted to get out of the Soviet Union. Soviet Union wouldn't let them leave. Suddenly this becomes a major cause within the United States. And Nixon and Kissinger are thinking, hang on, we're going to get rid of detente because of 32 Pentecostals? What is this about? I mean, it was completely out of step with the way that they thought about the world, which Kissinger in particular, very, very realpolitik materialist way of thinking about the world. Now, one of the reasons why this was effective was because this was an instance of all of the major religious groups speaking with one voice. Now, that's very rare, but that is something that politicians actually take notice of, because it's quite a surprising contradiction to the way that we usually think about religious groups in the United States, which is they all disagree with each other.
Right. Big fragmentation, denominationalism.
Exactly.
Right.
You can normally expect that on any given political issue, evangelicals will be on one side and mainline Protestants will be on another side. Mm-hmm. So that's surprising. But the second thing is that most favored nation trading status is an issue that's decided by Congress. This is one of the foreign policy powers that Congress actually has over trade and treaties. And this is where lobbying is actually really effective. The state of Washington's own Scoop Jackson was a major, major figure in this. He was, I believe, one of these mainline Protestants who was very committed to saving Jews from another Holocaust, and the military and aerospace industries here in the state of Washington also might have had something to do with
Boeing. Mm-hmm.
With the fact that he was not a fan of detente. So it's these foreign policy instruments that are controlled by Congress, trade, treaties, most favored nation status. These are the areas where religious groups can really extract pressure. Now, this is why religious groups have been so successful in an area like this and in human rights in general and religious freedom, and yet so unsuccessful on issues around war and peace. And Helen Milner and Dustin Tingley have a really interesting new paper saying that actually over the years, the reason why American foreign policy has become so militarized is that presidential administrations have deliberately used the military rather than other foreign policy instruments to achieve aims in order to take power away from Congress and to centralize it in the hands of the administration. But as long as there is still power over some foreign policy mechanisms in Congress, that's where religious groups can really exert pressure. So the story of this is that, yes, detente got torpedoed. It got torpedoed by a coalition of religious groups operating through Congress. Ford essentially abandoned it. Carter was forced to explicitly repudiate it, and then Reagan absolutely shredded it. Another major long-running consequence of this was the rise of human rights discourse. So what we now saw for the first time with Jimmy Carter was a president explicitly saying that concern with human rights within another country's border could trump concerns with national sovereignty. So this is a very anti-Westphalian kind of way of thinking about foreign policy, but that arguably is orthodoxy now on both sides. So this was a very effective campaign in terms of its long-running effects. And one of the things that it eventually led to was the International Religious Freedom Act.
Tell us a little bit about that.
So this was the product of about a decade of lobbying, I believe, by both Christian and Jewish groups, with the National Association of Evangelicals generally taking the lead. And this was a post-Cold War coalition who were concerned in particular that the Clinton administration was really soft on the issue of religious freedom around the world. And especially now that the Cold War was over, there was a real feeling that why are we supporting repressive regimes? Why are we supporting regimes that suppress religious minorities, especially Christians? We don't need to do this anymore. And so this is the origin of the International Religious Freedom Act. What this act required was that every embassy would really closely monitor violations of religious freedom in their countries. And this gave rise to this terrific data gathering exercise where every year Congress produces this really detailed international religious freedom report that in every country, any instance of vandalism of a Jewish cemetery, of someone being spat at in Germany because they're a Muslim, all of these instances get included in these huge reports about just cataloguing violations of international religious freedom. And these reports were the basis of one of the greatest works on scholarly works on religious persecution, which was Brian Grimm and Roger Finke's work, which basically coded all this up quantitatively to see what the causes of it were.
And we've talked with Roger Finke about this before, and we'll link back to that podcast on
yes.
that.
Yeah. So, but it's really been a contentious issue about how much the International Religious Freedom Act should have in the way of teeth and enforcement mechanisms. The way that it currently works is that countries that are particularly egregious violators are deemed to be countries of particular concern, CPCs, and those countries are not eligible for normalized trade relations. So Vietnam is on the outside because of that. The US actually broke off relations with Uzbekistan over this. And Uzbekistan had been seen as this valuable ally in the war on terror. It allowed the country to be used as an air force base for the US. But the violations that actually deemed it a country of particular concern were against Islamists. This is one of the really interesting effects of this, is that the State Department meticulously catalogued abuses against any religious minority, Scientologists, Islamists, and the fact that the Uzbekistan regime was killing about 5,000 Islamists a year, that put them really beyond the pale. This exercise is, I think it's very admirable in a lot of ways, but it's not an exercise designed to maintain frictionless relations with other countries. I had a friend who used to work at the State Department, and he said the worst day of every year was when that report would come out and when American allies like Turkey and Germany would be on the phone saying, look, how dare you tell us how to run affairs within our own country?
Now, this is rather interesting, because what we were talking about before is how religion can be very effective, one, when you get a coalition of supporters within the United States from across the spectrum on some issue, and number two, that it's run through Congress. Now, the International Religious Freedom Report, I know it comes from the State Department.
Yes.
But yet it's used quite frequently by Congress for nitpicking a whole mess of other issues that might not even be related to religious liberty. It's like, well, we don't really want to trade with that country because they're threatening our apple industry. And so we'll just, look at the report on religious freedom here.
That's right.
So I can imagine that's very frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, it was the State Department that was given responsibility for collecting all the information. And when this was put together, it wasn't just a concern with the Clinton administration being soft. It was that concern that Patterson mentions about that the whole culture of the State Department was so secular and so blissfully ignorant of religion this was one of the ways of trying to remedy that from the point of view of Congress. But it's Congress that then carries out the enforcement of any sanctions against any kind of violation of religious liberty. And so we can see this as a really slow-burning effect of that original religious coalition back in the 60s that campaigned for the rights of religious minorities in the Soviet Union. But today it's a far broader kind of concern. And I think that one of the things that gives the International Religious Freedom Act legitimacy is the fact that it's concerned with all religious groups. It would not have legitimacy, even though it's been largely pushed by evangelical groups. They realize that this wouldn't have any legitimacy if it was just framed in terms of protecting the rights of Christians around the world. This had to be about everybody, which is why it also includes the rights of Scientologists and Islamists.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. I'm just to toss out an issue that is relatively current here in talking about how religion can have an impact on foreign policy. We're talking right now in mid-May here. Well, actually, May 8th is when we're recording this. It'll come out a few weeks later. But a big issue that has hit the news recently is this. I think it's called Boko Haram. Thank you very much. Where there's these girls who are kidnapped by an Islamist group, and now you see everybody holding up these hashtag bring back our girl signs on the internet. Is there, it seems like a custom-made issue where a lot of different religious organizations could organize around this, both evangelicals because they're concerned mm-hmm. about Christianity,
yeah.
but Catholics and mainline Protestants because they're concerned about human rights abuses. Do you think this might have any impact?
Well, look, I've seen, in terms of people I know of different religious affiliations, yeah, I've seen a near universal kind of adoption of this as a cause. But this is where you run into another major obstacle, which is who's going to bring back the girls? Are we yeah. suggesting mounting a military operation?
Yeah.
Are we suggesting spilling American blood over this? We've all seen in recent years how little patience Americans have left for foreign interventions that are sold as humanitarian interventions. And everybody agrees that this is horrible. But we remember that the United States didn't get involved in the Rwandan genocide because of the memory that Americans had of 19 Marines dying in Somalia. American tolerance for the spilling of American blood in conflicts that is not directly seen as related to American interests is very low, and especially low after a war about which the majority of Americans now feel wasn't related to U.S. interests and yet claimed 4,000 American lives. So, yes, this is the sort of thing that everybody can get upset about together, but it's when people demand the return of the girls, it's not clear what we can do other than basically asking Boko Haram to give them back, which Boko Haram is not going to do. The problems in Nigeria are not just to do with pervasive religious conflict there. It's to do with the fact that in some areas the state is very weak.
Right.
The state can't protect civilians. And there was a particularly horrible incident in Nigeria 2 days ago when soldiers who were out looking for the abducted girls left a town ungarrisoned, and subsequently there was an attack that killed dozens of people. So, yes, this is a human rights issue that we can all get upset about, but it's unclear what the United States government would actually be able to do.
This might be an indication of how the role of religion can play a major influence but also show its limitations
yes.
in many respects, because all of a sudden, you know, idealism or the, you know, ideas going back to manifest destiny or protecting the world, making it safe for democracy, run up against very hard real politic, not only in the world but at home. Yeah, we don't want to commit soldiers to this kind of thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that is, you know, that is where we do see the limits of religion in politics, and that's probably one of the reasons why there has been so relatively little scholarship about religion in international politics, because people have always seen those kinds of limitations to it.
So we've been talking about human rights here, and that's an area that it seems that religion has had a greater influence relative to other things. Are there any other areas that religion does play a significant role in shaping foreign policy or international relations?
There's, I think that it's issues around foreign aid. It has played a major role in terms of the government's response to human trafficking. And both of those areas, critically, are once again areas where you have broad religious coalitions campaigning for more allocations of resources. And I think that in those issues in particular, politicians often actually see it as a cheap way of looking good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, these allocations to these areas are relatively small when you look at the entire budget, especially when you look at the military budget. But they make politicians look good, and they make politicians look compassionate in a way that pleases religious leaders.
Yeah. You get to send over, you know, aid with certain religious groups, and everybody's smiling, handing out clothes and food, and
that's
looks
right.
pretty
yes.
good. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. One other issue I want to finish up with is something that you've written about, and that is climate policy.
Yes.
And you've written a paper recently on evangelicals and climate policy, and have some very interesting findings here that the international arena is different than the domestic arena when it comes to evangelicals looking at this whole issue of environmental politics. Explain this a little bit.
Yeah, so what we find is that evangelical attitudes towards the environment, towards environmental destruction, and towards the need to do something about it really aren't very different from the rest of the population. And even though within evangelical thought there's the dominion idea that we were that God gave us the earth to use, there's also the stewardship idea that we should look after it. And those two ideas, I think, are probably equally powerful within evangelicalism and exert equal effects. So the result is a wash. But evangelicals distrust international binding agreements as a means of helping the environment. And there are a few reasons for this. The most important reasons are, first of all, back to this idea of American exceptionalism. The idea that the United States would allow other countries to effectively bind what the United States can do, allow socialist and Islamist and secularist countries to constrain the United States, that is a complete affront to American exceptionalism, which is an idea that American evangelicals tend to really stick to. The second thing is, coming back to dispensationalism, there's a lot of suspicion about what international institutions, especially really big ones like the UN, actually are. And what we might call the Jerry Falwell position is that when the Antichrist arrives, it's going to be in the form of the head of an international organization. And that really makes the UN a very suspicious entity. A different position, what we might call the Pat Robertson position, is, look, international cooperation on major issues like this is a waste of time. Right? The end is coming soon enough, and we have to prepare for that by being righteous, not by entering into useless international agreements that might compromise who we are as a people in order to try to achieve that. So both of those streams of thought, and if you think of the immensely popular Left Behind novels, they actually portray a scenario where the Antichrist is, I think, is actually the head of the United Nations. So the idea of achieving action on climate change through these international frameworks sets off alarm bells for a lot of evangelicals, not for all evangelicals. Evangelicals are a very diverse group with a lot of different strains of thought. But for enough of them to show a statistically significant and substantive effect in terms of evangelical disagreement with international treaties as a way of achieving anything.
And going on what was said earlier of trying to build broad coalitions on this, that basically it would probably be very difficult to do with a lot of mainline Protestants that would probably support things like the Kyoto Protocol, and that just only muddies the waters when it comes to negotiating a lot of these things.
That's right. I mean, mainline Protestant churches have been almost uniformly internationalist since World War II, really. And coming back to Reinhold Niebuhr, you know, this is a particular sort of legacy that he left to mainline Protestant churches. The Catholic Church is by its nature very internationalist.
Right.
And the Catholic Church often tends to align with mainline Protestant churches on any issue in which abortion is not involved. Yes, but this often leaves evangelical Protestants as the odd ones out in terms of not trusting international cooperation as a way to achieve things. It's not that evangelicals are against any international cooperation. I think evangelicals like the idea of getting along with your neighbours and, you know, acting cooperatively in an international way, but never in a way that compromises American interests, and certainly never in a way that involves constructing new institutions and new sets of rules in order to achieve aims. They get really suspicious about this.
Let me ask a few closing questions here, offering you to reflect in part on your position too. You're from Australia.
Yes.
And you've spent significant time here in the United States at the University of Michigan and now out here at the University of Washington. Do you see similar patterns in Australia, or is it a much different beast out there?
It's very different in Australia. I would say that religion plays no role in foreign policy at all. Australia has a religious profile that is much more similar to a European country, but unlike European countries, churches aren't particularly powerful lobby groups, except in a couple of areas like education. I really don't see any kind of involvement of religion in foreign policy in Australia, although you do get the same kind of attempts to lobby. Certainly, mainline Protestant churches in Australia, like the one that I grew up with, very big on peace, nuclear disarmament, the environment, and I remember anti-apartheid campaigns in the 1980s, very big on that. But yes, I would say that religion plays an even smaller role in somewhere like Australia.
And then let me ask you this in terms of the foreign policy blind spot. We had talked about that earlier, that 1979 Iranian Revolution State Department caught flat-footed. Is there a danger with that, that there isn't as much of a lobbying presence of religious organizations in Australia or in Europe, and that might make it a little bit more difficult for foreign diplomats in those parts of the world to really understand what's going on in other parts of the world? Is that possible?
It is possible, but I think that the broader problem that Australia has is the same problem that American diplomats have had, which is taking the Protestant Westphalian world for granted and thinking that this is the only world that's really possible. It amazes me the extent to which a lot of Christians don't realize the diversity within Christianity itself on the issue of the separation of ecclesiastical and state authority. Now, Eastern Orthodox churches have a very, very different view on this. Eastern Orthodox churches are often very supportive institutions of the state. Even the Coptic Church in Egypt currently is supporting a regime which is completely neglecting them. This is even before we get to someone like the Amish, who you'll never hear Amish talk about individual rights. Their point of view is we need to be completely submissive towards the state. So if you think about the diversity within Christianity on this issue and how little we often even think about that, and then think about Islam, which in itself is as diverse, if not more diverse, on the issue of the separation of religious and state authority. There are lots of different schools of thought on that, and there's a real danger in seeing either Christianity or Islam as an undifferentiated mass that we can deal with as one group.
And I guess the final question that relates to all this, since we were talking about scholarship in general at the beginning of this podcast, is do you think that scholars will continue to take the issue of religion seriously in international relations and start to make an impact on the way that diplomats and regular citizens around the world view the global environment?
I think so, and I hope so, because this is not going away. And I think that the work that people like Dan Philpott, Dan Nexon, Jonathan Fox, Elizabeth Shackman Hurd have done has really created a very fruitful research agenda for this going forward. And I do hope to see state actors paying more attention to it.
Well, we here at Research on Religion are always about enhancing religious agenda, or not religious agendas, but religious scholarship out there in the world of academia. So I want to thank my guest today, David Smith. Thank you for being on Research on Religion.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.